listeners. You are listening to Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180 AM and excellentcultures.com. This is your host, Zach Gandra. And with me, as always, the immutable Steve Gandra. How are you, Steve?
I'm just wondering when you're going to come up with another I word. Hopefully it's not four letters so that we can keep our PG rating.
I don't know if there's a four-letter swear word that starts with I.
Starts with I. Well,
idiot.
That's not four. We want to keep our PG rating, that's for sure.
Our G rating, yeah, I think, actually.
Yeah, I think it's PG.
Here on Clay 1180 and, of course, excellentcultures.com, we can say whatever we want. But Clay 1180, they've got those people with the buzzer buttons.
And yeah, they'll bleep you out.
They'll just bleep you right
they'll
out or kick right us right out. Off the radio station.
Blip you right on.
What is that? That's not the FDA, right?
I don't know. It's
not the ATF.
It's the broadcasting guys. I forget the name.
The FTDs? Or are those florists?
It's the telecommunications. Like I don't know. Yeah. FTC.
FTC. There you
Federal
go.
Trade Commission.
Well, either way, as I'm kind of adjusting our mics because I got a little bit of peak action going on here, we wrapped up July. We're now into August. We wrapped up our July Achieving Excellent Cultures workshops. You want to say anything about those?
Well, you know, I wouldn't call it spectacular. Actually, our guest today participated in the last workshop, so he can probably speak to it better than I can.
Nice.
But very well attended. Lots of great leaders, you know, from middle managers to CEOs. Lots of different companies represented. The feedback on the evaluations was 4.6 on a scale of 5. There were no threes, all fours and above.
Wow.
So folks are really, you know, getting into the let's make our culture great.
My ISP provider was there, I heard, and my internet's gotten better since they went through the program.
So they were happy. They were happy when they were there.
Apparently.
That was great to hear. So anyway, you can ask our guest later if he has time to talk about it following all the questions we're going to pepper him with.
Well, why don't you introduce him?
So Herman Forrest is an awesome guy. You'll get to know him shortly. Amazing guy. Comes originally from New York. Out here in the Northwest now in his job of leading the technical side of all of the Microsoft stores. So if you've ever shopped in a Microsoft store or if you've ever gone online or if you experienced good times, bad times, or happy times, sad times at a Microsoft store, this is the guy that makes all the technology for the Microsoft stores work with his team.
Nice.
You know, just hearing Herman's story and his background, you know, maybe we can get him to talk a little bit about his background. I hope we can. He's got one of the coolest moms on the planet that just, you know, led him in such a way that he's become an awesome human being as well as a great leader.
So is this the first guest that you've met their mom?
No, I've never met his mom, but I've heard him talk about her, and I feel like, you know, she reminds me of my mom.
Awesome.
Only my mom wasn't as tough as his was.
Your mom threw shoes.
Anyway, yeah. My mom threw shoes.
Let's welcome him. Let's welcome him.
Herman, welcome, you know, to Biz Culture Matters. We're so happy you could join us. You could join us today. So, Herman, tell us about, you know, you and your work with the Microsoft retail stores. Our listeners would love to hear anything you want to say.
So, I'm Herman Forrest, and thank you again for having me on the show. I'm the lead PM for the digital content experience team in Microsoft retail stores. And so, what I try to do is make the store experience more engaging. I don't know if you ever walked into a technology store and tried to buy a PC or a new phone or a new camera for your family, and it's often a very intimidating experience. So what we try to do is that we try to use technology, kiosks, interactive displays, exhibits, to lower the barrier, make it much more user-friendly, and make it more engaging so a person will feel comfortable actually buying their first PC.
Nice.
That's awesome.
I haven't bought a computer in a few years.
Yeah, Zach's a Mac person.
Haven't.
Okay. I bought a Mac in 2011, and I'm due for an upgrade of something, but I'm not going to spend the money on it. Probably, you know, I mean, don't people normally they spend the money on it once their existing one dies? Is that what normally happens in the stores?
Exactly. I mean, we have experience. I mean, most people have a 3-year upgrade cycle.
Yeah.
And so, as new technology comes out, new capabilities. For example, Windows 10 just released. And so usually that may actually buy a new PC.
So I should be talking to my boss right now about getting me some new equipment. It's basically what you're saying.
Yeah, he just looked at me.
Awesome.
Yeah, Steve, he just looked at me across the radio
desk. It's time for me to have a new computer, apparently.
Yeah.
Well, mine's 4 years old.
If Herman has anything to do with it, it will be a PC.
If you're buying, if you're buying, I might move over to a PC.
It will be a PC. I'm pretty sure we can work together and find some networks for your needs.
Looks like we just made a deal, Herman. We just made a deal.
Nice.
So tell us some more. I mean, folks who are listening from all over the planet, they may or may not have a Microsoft store in their neighborhood yet. Tell us some more about, you know, what your vision is, what you guys are doing, how your tech team is, you know, building the infrastructure of the stores, you know, online as well as in the stores where, you know, folks who haven't visited a store yet will automatically want to go in and figure this out or get online and find out very quickly.
So online is everything. I mean, we have several other vendors. We have, you know, almost every store, every major store, Amazon, Best Buy, Target, have an online component to their store. And also MicrosoftStore.com has an online component as well. But we have found that, you know, people really want to have a personal computer experience. They want to know the person selling the PC to them, and they want to have customized advice and guidance on purchasing that first PC. PCs are still a pretty expensive purchase for most people. I mean, the average PC, even though it's gone down the last 20 years, it is still could be very pricey for the average American family. And so what we try to do is find out the right PC for the right, you know, for the right family, for the right use case, for the uses they have for the PC. Sometimes the grandmother who wants to buy a new present for the grandson or the student who just got accepted to their college and they want a new PC. And so we try to tailor make that PC purchase with the features and functionality and value to be totally aligned to what the person actually needs and wants. We don't want to make it too much. I mean, everybody would need a high-end gaming PC that can do, you know, HD video. Some people just need a basic workstation where they can, you know, do email, you know, productivity applications like Word and Office and do internet communication. And so that's really the goal of Microsoft Store, to create a personal computer experience that's customized to you and deliver to you at a value that is affordable.
Yeah, that is really cool that you answered that question with not one single word that only a technoid would be able to relate to, Herman. All of us.
Yeah. Hey, that's no laughing matter because Steve couldn't get the microphone plugged into his computer.
Yeah,
today,
I know.
I'm not kidding.
Well, that's one thing that we have something. That's one thing we try to do. I mean, computing, as we all know, is personal. And I mean, one thing we had to say, you know, put the PC, personal computer, back in computing. We all talk about RAM and gigabytes and megabytes and space and allocation and cloud. But really, it's like, well, can I print a document? Can I email my teacher this document? Can I use this computer for work? Can I program this computer? That's a real, more tangible use case. Than trying to explain to someone, well, this computer goes, you know, this gigahertz fast or whatever, 3.2 or 4.3 is an Intel chip. And people really don't get technology. Technology should be grounded in real experiences, and we try to reflect that in the Microsoft Store.
Yeah, well, the thing I like about when you buy your PC, and I don't know if our listeners know this, but what I found out very quickly, because I've been a PC guy forever, and the new ones are extremely cool. When you buy a PC at the Microsoft Store, you don't get all of that advertising and other guys trying to make you use their stuff and their applications on the computer. You get clean stuff, and you get a personalized experience at the Microsoft stores, which I don't know that you can get that anyplace else. Every time you buy a computer online or at another retail store, it's just loaded up with everybody's applications who wants to sell you a membership to be on their deal.
And I mean there are several names for that. I mean, bloatware.
Yeah, bloatware. That's a good
It takes up valuable real estate on your precious hard drive for really, really no benefit. And so we do offer a line of PCs called Signature, where we make sure it's optimized, all the drives installed, it works out of the box. And actually, if you have any Windows PC, you can bring it into a Microsoft Store and get service on it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Not a PC you just buy from us, but any Windows PC. If you have any Windows PC, you could bring it into Microsoft Store and get a service. And that's the value that we try to, because usually sometimes they don't have, maybe you don't have that geek grandson.
Sure.
Or right. person in your life, sure. A tech professional in your life. And so Microsoft offers the ability for any PC that you have, as long as a Windows PC, you can come into the store and you can get a service.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so you don't have to go looking everywhere to find a tech guy that can fix it. You just bring it to the Microsoft store, and they can take care of it for you right there. That's amazing.
It's not like dealing with your company IT guy.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
Yeah. Exactly. And based on our expertise, I mean, we definitely have expertise in this space. Not just being Microsoft, but also doing, you know, Windows Update and a lot of hard drives, hardware support over the years that Microsoft been in existence. And so we definitely can get the PC working the way it should for you. And also, yeah, when you look at a new PC if you so choose. So it's definitely a win-win.
So I have a very critical, out-of-left-field question to ask you, Herman. And if you want to plead the fifth on this, you can. The other day in Redmond, Washington, where our offices are located, right downhill from the Microsoft campus, we had an all-day-long internet outage on the same day that the new Windows was released. And what I'm wondering is, was that all of the guys releasing the new Windows that took up so much space on the pipe that the rest of us were without internet for like 7 or 8 hours?
Yeah, so I will.
Is that a response?
That's a great question. that's a great question. So actually, how we release software to the world is that we have several servers. We use edge technology, where basically it's on the cloud and deploys around the world. So there's really no one point to a bottleneck, a choke point for pushing out software that way. I could say with, you know, pretty good confidence that it wasn't us.
It's not like old school manufacturing.
That's the answer I was looking for. You know, that's the answer I was looking for. But yeah. I did get my update, so I'm happy.
On that note, we have to go into our first break. Now that everybody in Redmond knows that your internet's out because of Comcast, not because of Microsoft.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Comcast or not. You know.
I'm not throwing anyone under the bus that could be a possible client. Yeah, but anyways, we got to go into our first break. Yeah, exactly. We got to go into our first break. You're listening to Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180 AM and excellentcultures.com. We will be right back after these messages.
Remember when your company was awesome? It was you against the world. Successful strategy, to-do list, done, supersonic growth. But over time, the sharp edge gets dull, and good is good enough. Why? Because companies forget that bigger is not always better, that politics crush people, innovation, and creativity. And before you can say rotten corporate culture, social media posts are infecting your business. The answer? It's not just your corporate strategies, it's your corporate culture. Excellent companies know that bad culture eats great strategies for breakfast. These guys really get it. Whether you're a family biz or a Fortune 500 or a new biz and want to get it right, excellent cultures can bring you back to awesome because they get it. What they know for sure? You don't need another consultant. Excellent cultures gives you what you need to get what you want. Bottom line business results that last. How do they do it? With successful business leaders as coaches and proven scientific data. They read your company's culture from inside out. Think MRI. They give you fast, accurate bottom line tactics. They don't treat symptoms, they go for the cure. Based on science, they reveal the hearts and minds of your people using proven and concise data, not warm and fuzzy psychobabble. And here's the kicker. You get supervisors who coach and inspire, workers who love their work, and everyone, that's everyone, not just the boss, takes ownership and accountability. It just doesn't get much better than this. And if you're wondering if Excellent Cultures works, just ask a few of their grads. Don't let the culture monster eat your strategy for breakfast. Check it out for some free advice from one of their experts now, or start it yourself with their complimentary online business culture MRI.
We are back, everybody. You're listening to Excellent Cultures, Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180 AM. And excellentcultures.com. We just finished asking Herman the big, mighty question on last Tuesday when our internet was down? Was it because Microsoft was sucking up all the internet bandwidth? And he told us that it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. That's so great to hear. It doesn't work that way. So great to hear. So, Herman. No, it doesn't. Yeah. Yeah. And if you knew Herman, you would know that he is definitely telling the truth. And since our subject, yeah, since our subject, because if he didn't tell the truth, his mama would fly all the way here from the East Coast, and she would grab him by the ear and drag him all over Redmond, Washington.
So we're going to have to hear about Herman's mom.
Are we telling the truth, Herman?
You are telling the truth, and probably should bring my grandmother in tow.
Yeah, your grandmother too. Your grandmother too. So tell us. You know, this is a show about a culture of ethics, values, and employee engagement, and we want you to share with our listeners your vision for what a business culture of ethics, values, and employee engagement looks like in your mind. But most importantly, we want to hear. I was so impressed when I heard the story about how your mama built into your consciousness, your soul, so to speak, a culture of ethics, values, and employee engagement when you were growing up. Our listeners definitely want to hear about that because not all of us had a mama that is rigid and disciplined and effective at developing a young leader as you did.
Thank you. So I'll definitely address. I will talk about like my background and I guess my genesis story if I was a superhero, of how I came to be, and then I'll fast forward right into how I lead my organization.
Perfect.
At Microsoft.
Perfect.
So I was raised in Harlem, and I spent time in the South Bronx, and just to give some reference, Harlem has changed dramatically in the last 30 years. So this was Harlem back in the 70s. And Harlem back in the 70s, it was very, very akin to a third world country of today. High crime, high unemployment, drugs, violence, all the things that you consider in working in a modern day, I guess, American ghetto in various, various respects. So I was born to this. I was born into this by a teenage mom who was trying to raise me by herself. And she was very educated at the time. And she wanted to make sure she instilled in me certain values. And these values pretty much came from the church. I mean, it was highly, we went to church almost every three or four times a week. And it came from the values of that you have to work to be anything in this world. You have to work. And that work is not just external. It's also internal. It's that spiritual work that you do on yourself to be anything in this world. So that's how you're mining your mental garden, as Bernice will say all the time, and how you're speaking, how you're talking, what thoughts are running through your head at the time. And then also, how do you demonstrate that in your daily interactions? And so for her, it wasn't like a platitude of scriptures. It was more of, are you living your truth every day? And she would say that all the time to Herman, are you living your truth? And even when I wasn't the perfect child, she would remind me, Herman, are you living your truth today? And so that really grounded me and made me very focused on not just, externally making sure I'm doing the right thing, but also internally that I'm thinking the right way, I'm talking the right way, that my daily habits and manners and the way I walk about the earth is aligned to the values that I seek to be. And, I mean, of course, you have the thing about be true to yourself. And I think that my mom, without knowing, was trying to instill that value of, Herman, find your truth. Live your truth, and more important, be your truth. And that was end-to-end type thing. So from that, from having that kind of grounding, it was very, very clear that education was my way out of this moray of how to get out of the ghetto. And that's what I focused on. I became a chess player. My mom taught me how to play chess. Another thing that was actually helped me with strategy and understanding how to think long-term as well as short-term. And she became, very well known in chess. I was a national chess player, I was a nationally ranked chess player, and won several awards in science and technology, and had an aptitude for it. But just because of the aptitude for it, it didn't come by talent alone. I mean, she definitely motivated me to get me into the type of programs, the Boys and Girls Club, to make sure that I could have had access to technology I needed. How I came in computer engineering was a simple fact that my mom didn't have daycare. And so on Saturdays, I used to go down to her job, and she worked for an insurance company at the time. And there was a guy there named Yanku, and he taught me how to use computers. I mean, he was a guy that taught me computers. So every Saturday I would go down and teach and learn from him how to use computer systems, and that's how I determined a love for computers. My mom couldn't afford to buy me a computer, so that was a way that, you know, I got pretty much free training from an expert in computer technology, and that's how the story began.
That's amazing. What really impressed me was how you told me about how she got you to wear a coat or a shirt and tie and carry a briefcase to school every day. No backpacks for this guy. Exactly. I mean,
Steve, you did that under your own volition.
No, I didn't.
It was very surprising. And I guess also have a name like Herman. It was also one of the things that stand out. But I think that the lesson she's trying to teach me is that just because you're here doesn't mean you have to act this way. And where in your clothes say so much about you than you are. Les Brown has a good comment. You want to dress like a prospect as opposed to a suspect. And so I use that very often. And she instilled it. I mean, from every day, from kindergarten up to high school, I wore a suit and tie, like a shirt and tie, and had a briefcase.
Yeah.
Because she was trying to train my mind to make sure that you will not do what Brian was doing. You will be something else.
That's great.
And it has been remarkable. I mean, especially in New York City, high heat, summertime, wearing a suit and tie on a train or whatever. But it was actually those lessons that helped me understand that, you know, you can be a business person. You can be what you want to be. You can transform yourself.
Are you wearing
your own work and your own effort?
Are you wearing a suit and tie right now?
No. Microsoft.
I was going to say Microsoft attire.
Yeah.
Microsoft and suit and tie. I think it's really an East Coast thing because I think the West Coast is much more laid back.
Yeah,
a little bit.
If I wear a suit and tie at Microsoft, they'll think I'm interviewing somewhere else.
Well, they think you're a customer. Think you're a customer instead of Microsoft.
Exactly.
Yeah, Microsoft and suit and tie is an oxymoron. Isn't that an oxymoron? Microsoft and suit and tie.
It was a lesson about how to be professional, basically, you know.
Yeah, way to go. So tell us how that impacted how you lead and how you lead your team and your people as a result of it.
So I guess the main thing that I try to push is awareness, is making sure that I'm aware. I mean, as a leader, you're not looking at your own actions. Your own actions reflect a lot. I mean, social science research, you know, clearly states that the actions of team leadership actually affects the environment of the employees and direct reports that you have. So I make sure, I consciously make sure that my communication, my outlook, my emails, the way I greet people, how I give feedback to other people, is in a way that is considered, you know, I consider highly ethical, in a way that doesn't damage their actually respectful of their humanity. And so even what I consider like criticism that is done in a way that still maintains that relationship that I'm trying to build with my direct reports or just in my team in general. And so I think that, you know, the common cliche, lead by example, but that is so true. I mean, you have to, as a leader, you have to constantly kind of monitor yourself and gauge yourself. And also I have a set of peers who can check me every time I'll get out of hand. You know, sometimes you may send an email or have a response that is not appropriate, and so you have a good set of people that can check you at the same time, mentors mostly, that can look at you and say, well, Herman, this is the way you should handle this and that way you should handle that. And so I definitely make sure that I seek their advice when I have issues with, you know, just in team management or in general.
So that's a really big concept that you just laid out here. You know, have colleagues and have folks on your team that can check you. Just being checked by others in the corporate environment is not exactly corporately politically correct these days, because everybody wants to get away with whatever they want to get away with, and everybody smiles and nods their head and says, whatever, you're the boss. How do you create that kind of culture where people, you know, not only feel comfortable checking you when they think you're off base, but it actually happens?
So, my direct reports to my team. So my team, I see myself more like a coach, and we sit at a round table when we talk, and it's pretty much, you know, that we're all equals here. The goal is to, you know, to deliver a feature or deliver a product or service to the stores, but anybody's idea is on the table. And to do that is that you start asking questions. You know, you make sure that dissent is openly heard and aired, and that people's ideas is here. I mean, at Microsoft, one thing that we do have is that we have a lot of brilliant people. Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of people who are very smart and very passionate about technology.
Yeah.
And so the question is, how, and not how you lead people, but how you lead smart people doing the right thing. And to do that, you have to give them the freedom to express the ideas, to support them in decisions, and have them, and also let them lead themselves. I don't feel myself as, you know, I guess like an old school manager. Oh, well, you should do this, X, Y, and Z. I give them more of an objective to achieve, and have them determine what, how the objective should be achieved, as long that we agree on what should be achieved. Because that gives the person the freedom to explore their own strengths and capabilities and bring value back to the team. And so, and that's what kind of culture I try to foster.
Yeah.
And also, I'm also trying to be very humble with it. I try to be very humble in leadership, because I realize that if you take on an ego-centric, like it's about me approach, your team will reflect that as well. And it'll just basically, your team will have chaotic culture, which actually hurts productivity and hurts the ability to get anything done.
Beautiful. It's well said. I love that.
Yeah.
We got to go into our second break and say hello to our advertisers, which I think is us. But we'll do it anyway, because we've got to do it for the radio station. You're listening to Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180 AM and excellentcultures.com. We'll be right back right after this.
Remember when your company was awesome? It was you against the world. Successful strategy, to-do list, done, supersonic growth. But over time, the sharp edge gets dull, and good is good enough. Why? Because companies forget that bigger is not always better, that politics crush people, innovation, and creativity. And before you can say rotten corporate culture, social media posts are infecting your business. The answer? It's not just your corporate strategies, it's your corporate culture. Excellent companies know that bad culture eats great strategies for breakfast. These guys really get it. Whether you're a family biz or a Fortune 500 or a new biz and want to get it right, excellent cultures can bring you back to awesome, because they get it. What they know for sure? You don't need another consultant. Excellent cultures gives you what you need to get what you want. Bottom line business results that last. How do they do it? With successful business leaders as coaches and proven scientific data. They read your company's culture from inside out. Think MRI. They give you fast, accurate bottom line tactics. They don't treat symptoms, they go for the cure. Based on science, they reveal the hearts and minds of your people using proven and concise data, not warm and fuzzy psychobabble. And here's the kicker. You get supervisors who coach and inspire, workers who love their work, and everyone, that's everyone, not just the boss, takes ownership and accountability. It just doesn't get much better than this. And if you're wondering if Excellent Cultures works, just ask a few of their grads. Don't let the culture monster eat your strategy for breakfast. Check it out for some free advice from one of their experts now, or start it yourself with their complimentary online business culture MRI.
We're back with Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180 with excellentcultures.com, talking with Herman Forrest from Microsoft, specifically the Microsoft stores, the retail stores. And if you did not hear the first part of this interview, you definitely want to go back and catch the podcast at excellentcultures.com/podcast, because Herman told you exactly how to get the best deal on your next computer and how to make sure you don't have all those, I think he called them bloatware, all those bloatware applications slow you down and try to sell you stuff of just, you know, serve you for what you bought the computer for in the first place. So make sure you listen to that. But now we're talking about even more critical stuff. Before the break, he was telling us how his mom, you know, from growing up as a young man in Harlem, wearing a shirt and tie to school and carrying a briefcase every day, helped impact the type of culture and the way that he leads, you know, his team at the Microsoft stores on the technology side. But now, Herman, we want you to talk to us about, you know, Microsoft's a big company, and you've been around a lot of big companies in your career. And Microsoft specifically is going through a huge internal culture change right now from, you know, your former CEO to your current CEO, and an environment that is less internally competitive and more collaborative, which is, you know, the style that, you know, Satya leads with, which, you know, is certainly, you know, a proactive way about of doing culture. But, you know, the shift is the challenge. Where have you seen, you know, cultures like you like to radiate, you know, just in your experience at Microsoft or other places and all the clients you deal with, start to break down? I mean, what are the trouble signs that our listeners should look out for that, gosh, bad culture is starting to creep in on me? What do we do to stop it?
So that's an excellent question, and you're right. I mean, Microsoft has, in the last 2 years, has seen a lot of transformation as we move from, you know, more standard box software to more of a cloud-based mobile software company. It has been tremendous, and also transition between Steve Ballmer and Satya, as far as the leadership changes as well, has definitely impacted, positively impacted Microsoft for the better. Culture deteriorated. So I really thought hard about this question, and what I came up with is that when cultures are deteriorating, you don't have to wait for an organizational health index score for that. You know, the organizational health index is a yearly survey that we do for Microsoft employees, where we try to gauge our health as an organization. But usually, the warning signs are way before that. You know, it starts with, I guess, even having a conference call. How are your conference calls going? Is there a level of, I guess, kindness in your conference calls? What is the kind of feel in the room? Do you want to be there? Do you wake up in the morning and want to go to work? Like those kind of questions were more internal. That is where I think the culture deteriorates. I don't think that deteriorates all at once, but it deteriorates by, you know, each employee have a certain perception of that culture, which builds what it takes to work. And then that builds in what happens to the culture, and the culture eventually falls apart. The leadership is also very important. As I said before, we all can recognize that leadership has such a huge impact of culture. But also, what happens when things go bad? Can you admit when things go bad, we didn't do the right thing in a certain area? And can you admit that openly and then work to a resolution? So how you resolve your mistakes, because no one's perfect. No one makes the right business strategy decision all the time. No one plans for every eventuality. So what happens when your company or your team makes a mistake, and can you openly address that? There, you know, when I was working on it was Windows 8 at this time, and we had a small issue with localization of text. Now I know that it seems like something that's kind of esoteric, but basically Microsoft software ships worldwide. Having localization, having local text or the local language, is extremely, extremely important.
Yeah.
And we came late into the cycle. I mean, it was almost ready to ship the cycle, ship the product. Then we found out some of our in this case it was printer stuff. It wasn't localized properly. And the question is, well, what do we do now? Okay, so we found the issue. How do we address it? And so at the time, what we tried to do, we rallied around each other. We got the text done and we got it into the build. But really, and it wasn't about, well, actually the localization itself, was what the impact will have on the actual customer. And so keeping the customer in mind, when you lose the customer focus of what you're trying to do and why you're delivering, what value you deliver to the customer, you can see that there's sign of deterioration. So companies that do things that are pretty much somewhat anti-customer, they do things to either hurt or harm the customer. One thing that I guess is a recent matter is cyber attacks. I mean, we have seen so many breaches of customer data in the last 2 years, you know,
sure.
You know, government facilities, I think, you know, companies here in the Northwest have issues with, you know, protecting and securing their data. So I see securing your customer's data as number one priority. And Microsoft does as well. And so how do you do that? And when things happen, how do you address it? Do you come out, you know, and come clean early? Do you make sure you have good services for the customer to get back on track? Do you watch and do you protect them? Because customers trust us, especially with a technology company, with almost, well, not, I don't say lives, but definitely the live information. And information is everything in these days. It's powerful. So how do you address that? How do you do it in a way that's ethically standard? What would you do if you had that kind of situation happen to you? How would you want your company to treat you? And so companies that can respond well to those kind of things, I think that those are shows of how, you know, companies who are ethically, you know, highly considered highly ethical.
So
you know,
now
I try to expand it beyond. Yeah.
Now, okay. I know why Office 360 makes me reset my password every month.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we have several things. We have two-factor authentication. You know, we'll give you an email, but also a bunch of mobile telephone number. The reason why, so that just if something happens, we know that it's actually you.
Yeah.
And that's actually what that's all the security messages trying to make sure that if something does happen on that first level of security, you have a second layer of security that is more robust there to protect you. And that's all designed for to enhance the security and privacy on internet.
So now I can stop griping about resetting my password every month and be thankful that Herman and his pals are protecting my data from hackers and third world terrorists that might want to grab it and do something unethical with it.
True. Yeah, definitely true. I mean,
or one of your kids.
Or one of my kids.
but one thing I want to touch on also is how does the company see itself in the ethical landscape? I mean, we definitely talk about our corporate mission statements and our values and things that we profess that we are. But I try to see it in a more broadly way. I know Microsoft has contributed like $8.5 billion since 1984 to nonprofit organizations. You know, how do you see your company or your culture beyond the cubicle, beyond your office walls? Do you take into account the customers, the partners, the stakeholders, their environment? Is that part of your tenet as well? And if it's not, then it's just a problem because you can't work in isolation. It's not about profit. I mean, profit is definitely important. But it's not the only thing that matters. And so I continue to work on Microsoft because Microsoft has a very universal view, a very holistic view of how it sees itself and its place in the world and how to get back not just people who buy our software, but the people around the world.
Yeah. So the real – I heard three really big answers, Herman. I want to make sure we repeat these and our listeners get them because they're critical. The first one I heard was how do your people handle mistakes? When someone makes a mistake, do they own it, raise their hand, and say, my bad, I'm sorry, you know, I'll do everything I can to fix this? Or do they try to sweep it under the table and hide it and hope that they can hide out and nobody can blame them? Secondly, what I heard was, you know, do you really, really treat your customers like you would want to be treated if you were a customer? And or is it just all about getting the product shipped on time and the money and the numbers and everything that makes you look good? What's more important? You know, how you really treat your customer and are you treating them the way you want? And then the last thing I heard, I thought was, you know, really significant because, you know, you're talking about, you know, how do you treat everything and everybody around you? If you have no gain to be able to take advantage of from it, you know, do you donate just to get your name, you know, on the bulletin board of, you know, these are good guys because they're donating to a nonprofit? Do you, you know, treat people with different cultures the way you want them to, you know, you want to be treated yourself and care about? Are they able to understand it? And is the software able to communicate in their language that they can understand or relate to? So, I mean, three really big points that if the opposite of these is happening in your organization, you know, Herman's telling us, I think, and you should verify this, Herman, that these are signs of bad culture starting to creep in and you want to address them very quickly.
Yeah, it happens before, way before you have an Enron. It happens way before you have a news break or, you know, the federal charges are filed. You know, it happens very early with the little, I guess it's almost micro decisions.
Yeah.
Very small decisions that have, you know, cumulative big impact to the ethic or the cultural feeling or environment in your organization.
Yeah, very well said and very true. And who knows, had Enron been paying attention to those three trouble signs that you just gave us, you know, especially the one of how do you handle mistakes?
Exactly.
You know, if they'd been confessing them and sharing them and my badding them instead of, you know, covering them up, you know, what we know as the great Enron debacle probably never would have happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True.
It's very true.
Yeah. Great advice.
You know, we got to go into another break. So keep the questions coming, guys. This show's flying by. It's just going by fast. Herman, you're a great guest. You're listening to Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180 AM and excellentcultures.com, everybody. We'll be right back after these messages. Mm-hmm.
Remember when your company was awesome? It was you against the world. Successful strategy, to-do list, done, supersonic growth. But over time, the sharp edge gets dull, and good is good enough. Why? Because companies forget that bigger is not always better, that politics crush people, innovation, and creativity. And before you can say rotten corporate culture, social media posts are infecting your business. The answer? It's not just your corporate strategies, it's your corporate culture. Excellent companies know that bad culture eats great strategies for breakfast. These guys really get it. Whether you're a family biz or a Fortune 500 or a new biz and want to get it right, excellent cultures can bring you back to awesome because they get it. What they know for sure? You don't need another consultant. Excellent cultures gives you what you need to get what you want. Bottom line business results that last. How do they do it? With successful business leaders as coaches and proven scientific data. They read your company's culture from inside out. Think MRI. They give you fast, accurate bottom line tactics. They don't treat symptoms, they go for the cure. Based on science, they reveal the hearts and minds of your people using proven and concise data, not warm and fuzzy psychobabble. And here's the kicker. You get supervisors who coach and inspire, workers who love their work, and everyone, that's everyone, not just the boss, takes ownership and accountability. It just doesn't get much better than this. And if you're wondering if Excellent Cultures works, just ask a few of their grads. Don't let the culture monster eat your strategy for breakfast. Check it out for some free advice from one of their experts now, or start it yourself with their complimentary online business culture MRI.
We're back, everybody, and you've been listening to Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180 AM. And we've been on the phone with Herman Forrest, a Howard University graduate, massive avid chess player and chess champion, amateur salsa dancer. We didn't talk about the amateur salsa dancing yet.
Yeah, we need to talk about how you weave your world-class chess game and your salsa dancing into the same culture at the same time with your team at Microsoft. Do you have an answer for that question, Herman? Do you have an answer to that loaded question?
I do.
Go, then fire away.
No, I do. Actually, chess and salsa are very similar in a lot of respects.
Wait a minute. I want to take notes. I want to take notes on this one, Herman. I got to take notes.
Steve, you're a championship salsa eater.
Yeah, I can eat the salsa. I don't know if I can dance the salsa.
So people believe that that dancing in general requires rhythm. And there's some rhythmic quality to dancing. But salsa is a pattern-based movement. It's all based on patterns. And so the question is, if you can learn the patterns of the dance and you could duplicate the patterns, and by combining these simple patterns together is how you can dance salsa very, very well. So the people who actually dance very salsa, and they call it, you know, they really, you know, improvise salsa, they actually know the patterns very well in their heart. And they could recombine and combine, much like you would do a chess match, to get a certain effect. And so that's what salsa dancing in general is not. It's not improvisational as one may think. It's really combining these different techniques, different patterns, dance patterns, and dance moves together to produce a good dance, special dance.
So yeah. What I'm hearing is,
so I think I'm very aligned.
I'm hearing a software engineer tell me that soon we can look forward to an app on our phone that will help us learn how to be a great salsa dancer with algorithms and computer technology.
I'm gonna have to disagree because I saw Steve Wozniak on Dancing with the Stars, and that was a horrible mess.
But they didn't do salsa. They didn't do
salsa. Of course they did salsa. Of course they did.
It could have just been Steve.
But also,
I think I can totally see, you know, in some distant future, having, you know, a HoloLens on with your virtual partner. And able to dance, you know, by mimicking these moves, you know, be your HoloLens, your Kinect with television. I could totally see that happening.
I mean, Microsoft's already doing that
in the near future.
Yeah, I mean, it's already. I danced with my I danced with my friend's Xbox One the other day, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
And I was like on the screen moving the character with my body.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. A dance revolution. Yeah. So we're already doing that. And so I think that that's what it is. I really think it's really about patterns.
Interesting.
And, you know, showing patterns is a very fun way. And nothing is more fun than dance and having good music in the background.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You sold us on Herman. So let's talk about a second, the most recent Gallup poll. I mean, this is a poll that is released every other October, and for the last two releases in a row, we've got this 70% plus of American employees are effectively disengaged at work. This year, Jim Clifton, the CEO of Gallup, in his cover memo told us that there were 18% that actually said they hated their jobs, and the most common reason that they hated their jobs was they hated their bosses. So, and Clifton calls them a new generation of managers from hell, that people are, you know, they won't tell the boss, but they'll tell the confidential poll that we hate our jobs and we hate, you know, we hate. So what we're looking for from, you know, an accomplished chess master, salsa dancer, kid who wore a shirt and tie to school and carried a briefcase every day, moved from Harlem to Redmond, Washington, you know, to lead a team in the, you know, top technology company in the world. Tell us, Herman, what's the connection between a culture of ethics, values, and employee, you know, and this whole employee engagement, you know, conundrum that we're experiencing in America?
So I think that is definitely definitely another great question. I think that the disengagement trend of 70% of workers, you know, that's actually disengaged, it follows several other trends. I mean, one trend that is easily broken out that, you know, in 2008, presidential election, only 2/3 of Americans actually voted.
Yeah.
The people who were able to vote voted. 61%, right? What is the civil activism rate of Americans in general? Is much lower than most industrialized countries, most of our peers. You know, much lower than Sweden, England, you know, Japan, much lower. And so I think that this trend should be a national crisis that 70% of people who are working and have, you know, making a living for their families and their well-being feel that they're not connected to their job. They're not connected or in some ways, I guess, hate their manager. And hate is a very strong word. No, it's like, I consider it an emotional word. Yeah. Almost like they would like to do something else instead. So I think all these trends speak to something where that America, maybe America as a culture, is becoming more apathetic and less feeling and less caring, which is something that we all should be concerned about. I mean, I think that, you know, President Obama, whoever's on the team, should take it as a national item to actually work to change that, because it's a crisis. I mean, as we know, with disengagement comes pretty much high labor costs because people want to take a long time off work.
Sure.
Lower productivity, lower creativity, all these things that we really don't want when we fight in the global marketplace. So I don't know if I have any. I definitely don't have any answers to why things are trending that way. But the fact they are, and we know about it, and those polls are public, that we should all be doing something towards it. One thing I'm doing, at least what I am doing, is helping out young people with technology. So I, as you know, Steve, I'm working with underserved communities, engaging them in technology, teaching them, showing them how to build apps, showing them how to use technology for empowerment purposes. And that's one way to stem the tide, but at least in that smaller area, to do something. And everyone can do something. I mean, Kennedy was very, very true that what can America do for you? What can you do for America? How can you pick up a shovel? What can you do? Where's your culture of service? I mean, I would love to see more people getting service, either Peace Corps or volunteering at local PTA or doing little things, you know, helping create the street, whatever it takes to get service, because I realize service helps decrease apathy.
Yeah. You're
giving
you're...
back to someone, giving of oneself helps decrease that need to be self-centered in a sense. And
that's
so
huge.
I like to see more engagement in those spheres.
Yeah. It's very well said. In fact, and as you know, as a graduate of the Achieving Excellent Culture workshop, what we're essentially sharing and helping corporate America identify with these days is what you just said. I mean, that in effect, we can either have a culture of what's in it for me, it's all about me, a self-driven culture, in our organizations and teams and businesses, or we can have a culture of service, which is about, you know, how do we, you know, how do we serve not just the customer, but, you know, our fellow employees, our managers, our workforce. And it appears that kind of what we've lost, you know, in America since the 60s, when JFK reminded us that we should ask not, you know, what our country can do for us, but what we can do for our country. You know, we've lost this culture of service. And when the culture of service left, so did the culture of engagement left. And now we've got, you know, 70% plus folks telling the confidential poll that they, you know, are disengaged at work. They just go to get the money and then they go home and do what they really want to do. And 18%, you know, you know, hating their bosses and blaming the boss instead of, you know, the culture. When in fact, if we embraced what you're telling us, Herman, and got serious about building cultures of service. I mean, and here in Seattle, it's so great because, you know, at least in this season, we get to watch the Seahawks do so well and listen to the pregame and postgame interviews of all these, you know, multi-million dollar football players tell us that it's not about them. It's about the, you know, the defense or the offense or the line did it or the quarterback did it. And we see these servant attitudes on an NFL football team. Good golly, when did we ever imagine that would take place? But if a football team can do it, any company, any organization, or any nation can do it, we just need to pay attention. You know, I think
exactly, and we can't underestimate how difficult it is to change culture in general. But the only thing that really what the outcome is, you know, what legacy are we leaving for our children? What legacy are we leaving for the earth? We only here for a short period of time. What are we trying to do to make things better than when we left it?
Yeah.
That, you know, that is something that's very core in my family about leaving things better than we left it, or how my son who is a Boy Scout is like almost like leave no trace but make it better.
Yeah, okay? Exactly.
Make it better. Do something in the environment to make it for the betterment. And so that those things are core. I totally agree with you, Steve.
So Herman, Zach's giving me the 2 minute sign. In the last couple of minutes here, if you could put your coach's hat on for a second. And just share with the leaders that are listening to this broadcast, put your coach's hat on. What can we do as Americans, as business leaders, as managers and employees and executives? What can we do to help restore these cultures of ethics, values, and employee engagement, cultures of service, as you said it so well, in a meaningful way that they can take away and go start doing something?
So I'm going to pull a little bit from Jack Welch, who was the former CEO of GE.
Yep.
He believed highly in measurement. Measurement was one of the things that one of the factors, one of the Sigma Six principles, measurement and continuous improvement, which was taken from, Toyota plants in Japan.
Sure.
I believe that we have somehow magically have moved the economy down to a couple of numbers that everyone knows every day. We all know the Dow Jones. We all know the S&P. We all know what the Rutgers 5000, the Rutgers 5000, these numbers are, or the global index numbers are. We know what these numbers are, GDP numbers, we know they are. So somehow, all this complexity, we have a way to get this down to a single number, and we know it's going up or down daily. Do we do the same thing for trustworthiness, for ethics, for mental health, for service? Can we devise an algorithm, a system, to measure the nation's compassion? I think about that. I mean, I don't know. I'm not talking about a solve for it, but I think there is a way to measure our ability to be compassionate, our ability to be generous, our ability to serve it. Can we measure how many people are currently volunteering in some way? Can we have these measures that we actually track and that we try to move the numbers in a positive direction? And so we do this every day. I mean, everyone understands these numbers. These numbers are highly complex, but they are very simple and meaningful to even people who don't understand what the stock market is. And so can we do something like that for these other values, these other what I call soft values, but also critically important to our overall health and emotional well-being? Put a number to it. Can we put a number to it? Can we put a gauge to it? We have a gauge for everything in America. Can we put a gauge around these quote-unquote core principles that we want to promote better culture and better service and just better lives in general? Is it possible? Can it be quantified?
Good
That's
stuff.
More of
That's
a question.
Amazing.
I don't know if I answered your question.
No, well, it really did.
Something there.
It really did. So after the show sometime, we're going to grab coffee and figure out how we can partner up. And
we got to go, guys. App. You're gonna you guys
create
can work
an app that'll measure all this, that will measure all this.
Stay
stuff
on the phone,
and make
Herman.
A difference.
Stay on the phone, Herman. We'll have you talk to Steve and his personal secretary, which is me, in just a minute. Hey guys, we want to thank you for tuning in to Biz Culture Matters on Clay 1180 AM today. Hey, do something like about what Herman was talking about today. Maybe instead of engaging just on email, go to somebody's desk, engage somebody in person. Instead of just talking on social media, maybe go and sit down with somebody, have a good conversation. Don't just look for what you can be served as a leader, but go and look how you can serve others. We'll be back next time. You can engage with us at excellentcultures.com. Ask the experts at excellentcultures.com. Clay 1180 AM and excellentcultures.com. Signing off.